Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults. Here are your hosts, Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become the happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults that you want them to be. I'm Sandy Fowler, and I'm here with my co-host, Judy Davis. If you listened to episode 4, the Preventing Prescription Med Abuse episode, you already know that in addition to being podcast host, Judy and I are also experts at upstream solutions for preventing depression, addiction, and suicide in teens and young adults. So we spend time talking to teens and young adults and talking to parents. And I'll tell you what, parents are worried. They are watching their kids get more and more stressed. And then seeing kids as a whole dealing with the increasing stress, the anxiety rates, the depression, the addiction. We've seen lots of different violent outbreaks. We had the Florida school shootings and other school shootings. There's a rising suicide rate, and it's scary. So parents are trying to figure out what the problem is and why our kids can't cope.
It is scary, Sandy. And, you know, when I think about this problem, an interesting take comes up on it. And without knowing it, I think as a whole, we give our kids antiquated coping strategies. As we grew up, we kind of learned how to deal with things from our mentors, right? Our parents, teachers, grandparents, neighbors. Even in episode 9, we talked about the importance of networking and building a network that you can get support from. But here is the problem, and why I believe that a lot of these rates are rising. It's because the mentor generation for today's teens really doesn't have the experience in dealing with the issues and challenges that our kids face. It's heartbreaking, really. We're trying to give them coping strategies on things that we have no idea how to deal with.
Right. So all of this boils down to today's adults either just didn't learn coping strategies that work for themselves, or the coping strategies that we learned don't work for some of today's problems.
Exactly.
So it's all about coping strategies.
I think about it, and we hear this word thrown around a lot, coping strategies. Give your kids coping strategies. Give your kids. I need to understand, first of all and foremost, what the heck is a coping strategy? What do we mean by that? Because everyone's definition of that is different. And here at Mighty Parenting, we kind of have a unique take on coping strategies. So let's kind of start back at square one.
Yeah.
And go from there.
So let's go. What is a coping strategy? And you know, the way that we talk about it here is a coping strategy in general is something that helps you deal with daily life. The little bumps, the speed bumps, and the big fat potholes. So those are the tools that you utilize to live an emotionally healthy life.
Right. And adding to that, a coping strategy is a conscious effort or action that you take to solve a problem and help ourselves eliminate and deal with stress and anxiety or those blips and speed bumps that come up. You know, it's that effort, that action piece that we consciously do. It's not this ethereal build your coping strategies, actual conscious actions that we can take. And it kind of goes that there are all different kinds of coping strategies. There are healthy coping strategies and there are unhealthy coping strategies. So now that we know what a coping strategy is, let's talk about the difference, because there is a difference, right?
Right. Because there are lots of things that we do to deal with the stress in our lives, but that doesn't mean that it's good for us. And one of the things that I guess I could say I find frustrating is how much our society wraps itself around, rallies around, and encourages us to use unhealthy coping strategies. So Judy, we did a presentation at a university where we were talking to some kids and we shared some of the things that we saw when we were in college. And I shared some of the things, you know, like I learned an unhealthy coping strategy in college that I had never experienced before.
Okay, you have to get specific. I don't want the broad stroke, whatever. Yes. Tell us what you did.
Yeah. Well, so for the first time in my life, I'm living in a house with 22 women. And on any given night, you could go down to the kitchen and there would be a small group complaining about whatever's going on in their life and eating. And so I learned to stress eat. It wasn't something I did naturally. It wasn't something that I learned until I was in this new environment. It was a societal thing. That was the norm. That's what was expected. And that is a society norm. I watch movies all the time where that's how women are portrayed as dealing with stress. Men are portrayed as going to the bar and women are portrayed as eating ice cream. That is what is taught to us via the media, right? Mm-hmm. So right. That's not good for us. That is not that eating ice cream is a bad thing, but sitting down and eating the better part of a half gallon of ice cream and doing it not because you wanted some or it tasted good, but doing it because you're trying to stuff down your feelings.
And I think that's the key. You just hit on it so right on. It's not whether or not you're overeating or going to the bar or being a couch potato. It's none of those things in and of themselves are intrinsically bad. But when you use them, you know, we're going back to the definition of coping strategies, it's to alleviate stress or anxiety. When you use something like that as a way to escape, that's where it becomes unhealthy.
Right, because you have to look at, okay, so after I eat that ice cream, or after I drink this beer, or after I drive this car really fast, or after I do this thing, how do I feel? And I don't just mean for a couple seconds, because a lot of those things, you might get an adrenaline rush, or you get a momentary release. Mm-hmm. But are the feelings and everything that was there before just bubbling back up? Did it actually help you deal with it? It's kind of like venting. You know, Judy, you and I have learned the difference between healthy and unhealthy venting. In college, we would meet up on Friday night and go down to the Ambassador and we would vent about whatever was going on, the week, the school, the people, the whatever. But we didn't solve a problem. We didn't just need to let off a little bit of pressure and then be able to feel better and move forward. Mm-hmm. But just recently, you know, you and I were getting together to work on some business stuff and you're like, I just need to get this off my mind and vent it real quick. Once you vented it, you just went, this is, you know, you kind of not blew exactly, but you know, you just sort of blew out all this thought. And once that was gone, your mind was clear and you jumped to, okay, this is how I really feel about it and this is what I can do about it. And that's the difference. One was just squawking, bitching. The other was releasing and moving forward.
Right. And that's key. And, you know, when I look at college students today, I see tons and tons of kids vaping and smoking. That's like the thing. And I am someone who smoked in my 20s. I didn't smoke all through high school or college, but I smoked in my 20s. And it literally made me stop and take deep breaths. And it relieved some of the stress and anxiety. And it was unhealthy, even though I got an instant release of that pressure. So. Right.
But a momentary release too.
Exactly. And then there was more stress because I'd have to figure out how to go get more cigarettes so I could blah, 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 blah. But it's true. It's that, how do we know when it's unhealthy? I think the the gut check is, one, is it truly providing relief, or is it actually creating more stress just in a different way? And that's the thing. So we're out here as moms and dads and mentors and teachers, and we're going, okay, we understand coping strategies. We can tell a difference between healthy and unhealthy. So now I go to the thing of, what do I do?
Yeah.
How do I set up my life so that it can be more healthy coping strategies? Because we know we're not going to sit here and go, you can only have healthy coping strategies. We never want you to do something unhealthy. That's just not reality.
And it's not our reality.
No.
Right. You asked me the other day, you gave up all these vices for Lent. What ones did you keep? I'm like, potato chips. You know, I mean, because I knew better than to give them all up. But, you know, but we're making improvement. But going back to what you just said, Judy, which is, you know, what do we actually do? And this is the place where the way we approach this is a little bit different. And we talk about three building blocks for healthy coping strategies, because there's different kinds of stress. There are different things that happen in our life. So the first building, well, actually, let me give you the three building blocks and then we can talk about them. One is a foundational coping strategy. Two is for triggers, things that just happen, you know, kind of a bigger thing in the moment. And three is where it's a crisis, like it's a really big thing and the strategies you have totally do not work.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm hearing you saying is, as we set up a healthier lifestyle, we need to create three building blocks upon which that we can build over time. The first is we need to set a foundation to build upon, and then we need to have in place some strategies, if you will, for when things trigger us or when we have an acute crisis situation.
Yeah, let's think of it this way. So, you know, people talk about stress, but there are different kinds of stress. There are different levels of stress. And anybody's life is going to have some kind of stress in it on a daily basis. So there are things we need to be doing to deal with that stress. Every single time you feel a tiny bit of stress, you don't want to have to stop and quote unquote do a coping strategy. And think back to the last time that you were tired and your kid did something that, you know, it's kind of irritating normally, but you can deal. But when you were, and I'm talking really tired, right? It's like it just grated your nerves. You know, you can like think through it while it's happening and go, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm losing it. But you were too tired to be able to manage your response or your reaction. Actually, it's not a response. It's a reaction mm-hmm. to what they said because you just didn't have it in you. That's the idea of foundational coping strategies, is taking care of yourself on a regular basis so that you have a good solid foundation to work from.
You've likened it to regular car maintenance.
Yes.
When we talk about it, it's building this foundation of where we have this car and we have to make sure that the fluids are right. There's air in our tires.
We have gas.
Get gas, keeping it running smoothly and efficiently. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about that foundational building block. So give me some examples of that.
So what you put into your body, and we can talk about that from different ways, but let's start with the very obvious first. It's what you eat and drink. If you're dehydrated, your body can't function properly. If you are eating sugar, and this is, I'm saying this because my family knows, if I go on an extended sugar binge, I'm just plain crabby and I cannot manage my emotions. So, you know, eating the healthy foods, making sure you're hydrated, you know, trying to eat regular meals so that you're not just hangry, because that doesn't help anything. You know, all of those things that go through our mouth into our body affect us. But also what goes into your body, you know, what you're listening to and what you're watching and that, you know, that you've turned on different kinds of music, and it affects your mood. Some makes you want to dance. Some makes you want to shout. Some makes you want to lay down and take a nap. Mm-hmm. And it brings up different feelings. So noticing that, wow, when I listen to this music, it makes me anxious. Well, don't listen to it. Mm-hmm. Just don't do it.
Right. And things like, we overlook it a lot, and sleep, getting outdoors and getting the sunshine. And I never saw how important that was until I moved to the Pacific Northwest, where it doesn't really sunshine here. I have to really and truly think about how that affects me and my moods, because my moods directly impact my ability to deal with stress and anxiety. I'm an anxiety girl and stuff, which takes me to the trigger, because where it shows up.
Real quick though, Jude, there's one other thing. I talked about this place where society and our expectations and our culture are a big problem. Sleep is one of those places, because it has become a badge of honor to be sleep deprived. And if you mention that you're tired or you're sleep deprived, there is no sympathy. There is no help. There's just a, well, yeah, we all are. Mm-hmm. We need to buck that trend and do what we can to get sleep, because your body repairs itself. Your brain plays through everything and deals with it and sorts through what's mm-hmm. happening in your life. If you don't get enough sleep, literally, your brain does not have enough time to sort through your day and your life and everything that's going on. And it will leave you stuck in the things, the stressors from the day before and the day before and the day before, and they accumulate.
Okay. So as we're talking about this, you're a parent on the other side. This is really interesting, because it's not just for our kids. We don't want to just educate our kids on how to create these foundations. We want to do it ourselves so that we can parent more effectively.
We've said how many times on the shows, every expert we have on here has pretty much said the way to get the kids to do these things is to model them. They're going to do what we do. And if you're eating junk food, that's what's in the house. So how are your kids going to eat the healthy food? If you don't have, water bottles to haul water with you, if you don't go to bed, why should they? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need to definitely model those things. But Judy, I want to go to the next level. You just brought up, you said the trigger. And that, I think, is more of what people think of when they think of stress and anxiety, because we need the foundation for dealing with everyday life. Mm-hmm. And that's, like you said, you put gas in the car, you make sure you have air in the tires, because if you don't have those things, the car's not going to break down necessarily, but other than gas, but that's not a breakdown. That's just a momentary stop. But a trigger is more like, I got a flat tire. Something out of the norm happened. Mm-hmm. And I need to have the tools to deal with that. I need to have a jack in the back of the car. I need to have a spare tire in the back of the car. I need to have a lug wrench. So Jude, what are some coping strategies that can be used in those trigger moments?
I think that it can be as simple as take your shoes off and go walk on the ground. It sounds so simple, but grass, sand, dirt, they all have electrons that refuel our core of our nervous system. Mm-hmm. The electrons literally de-stress you. And so that's the first one. When my husband gives me a call, he calls and says, we have to talk tonight. Instant. It is a trigger. Those words, we need to talk tonight. It's the tone he says it in. Instantly, I am stressed and anxious and going to every worst case scenario. And I found that if I take off my shoes and literally go step outside into the grass, I'm able to calm down and then get rational again. Because when a trigger happens, we get irrational. We get, quote unquote, triggered, and our nervous system gets taxed. So that connection with the ground, drinking green, drinking green tea, there are L-thiamine or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it is. We'll put it in the show notes so that you know for sure. But it is this element that's in green tea that actually calms your nervous system. So it's those simple things. And I know, Sandy, you've got some that work for yourself.
I do. And unfortunately, we can't go into all of them. So I'm going to pick one to share, because this one, we call it getting touchy. And I love it because it's that play on words, because in a triggered moment, we'll feel irritable, kind of touchy. But actually touching things, hugging another person, hugging a teddy bear, wrapping up nice and snug in a warm, fuzzy blanket. Those tactile experiences, you can
petting your dog.
Petting a dog, petting a cat, and there are tons of scientific studies that show that that reduces stress, right? They bring them on college campuses now for exam week. Also, massage your own hands or feet. Those things also, they change our physiology. Stress changes our physiology. It makes your body release certain hormones. Doing these touching activities stops that process and switches it over to release different hormones. So, and the thing that I really love about the touchy one is that when your trigger involves another person, it's an opportunity to go, I'm having a tough moment here. Can I get a hug? And when the two of you hug, it actually improves both of your physiologies. After it's either 30 seconds or a minute, both your bodies will release the feel good oxytocin. Thank you.
Yeah,
that's a feel good hormone. So I love that, and we share information and teach these healthy coping strategies. We, of course, will be talking about them in our Mighty Parenting Facebook group. But what we're doing is also putting them out through the Mighty Parenting emails. So just go to mightyparenting.com, sign up for the email there, and you will get some info on various healthy coping strategies so that you can learn things that you can do in those triggered moments.
Yep. And finally, I just want to touch really quickly, because I know we're running out of time, is that sometimes we need a coping strategy when we're in crisis, whether our kids are in crisis or we're in crisis, and likening it back to that car thing, our engine seizes up, broken tie rods, and we need to go to the mechanic to take care of it. Coping strategies are the same. When we are in crisis or we can't take that edge off or release the pressure, whether it's for yourself or your child while they're away at college or while they're in high school, sometimes the coping strategies that we have in our toolbox are not enough and we need extra. So if that is a case for you or your kids, get outside help. It's okay to not be okay. Sandy, I know that we're going to be giving more tips on creating healthy coping strategies. So can you just wrap us up today, kind of give us a general brushstroke of what we talked about?
Yeah. So what we're talking about is coping strategies. You know, all these horrible things going on in the world, there are lots of things that can be done politically and things, but at home, within our families, for ourselves and for our kids, we can learn and model and teach and help our kids learn healthy coping strategies. And what we said is a coping strategy is a conscious action that you take to solve a problem or relieve stress or anxiety or a negative emotion. And there are healthy and unhealthy coping strategies. You know it's an unhealthy coping strategy if it doesn't give you relief, or if it gives you a momentary release, but that's paired with an unhealthy or a dangerous action, or that the coping strategy you're using actually creates more stress in your life. Healthy coping strategies actually help you to feel better and move forward with your life. And coping strategies, you've got, you know, three building blocks to help you get to that emotionally healthy life. The foundational things, the little things you do every day to keep you in the best shape possible for moving through life and dealing with the little bumps and things. Then you have things that you can use in the moment. The things that you use when there is a trigger, a momentary flare up of a problem. And you got to just kind of stop for a minute and do something. And then you have a crisis situation where things are just bigger than what you can deal with, and it's time to go for outside help. Maybe you have a friend who's or a family member who's an expert. Talk to the school counselor. Go check communities, run classes in healthy coping strategies, or go talk to a coach, a counselor, a therapist. Go to somebody who has tools that you don't already have.
I love it. I love it. And I'm going to look at my building blocks and kind of reiterate, make sure that I have things in place. Because as we talk about here, it's kind of just alerting me to that maybe I'm not doing the best job at some of that foundational stuff. So
time for a tune-up.
Yep, time for a tune-up. So it's also time to dig into Real Talk, where today we're going to be discussing grades and their impact on our kids right after this quick message.
Parenting is the toughest job you'll ever love. It's a common phrase because it's so true. And as the teen years roll around and you start seeing changes in your child and you may start wondering, what's going on? Are they okay? Is this normal? And again, as they move out of the house, go out on their own, go off to college, you see more changes. And sometimes the changes are perfectly normal. And sometimes they're an indication that your child's in over their head, that there are things going on that they can't handle. And the parents' worry and their concern is, how do I know the difference? Well, now there's a book that can tell you. It's Warning Signs, and it is a parenting guide to help you understand about those changes and to help you figure out if your child could be at risk for depression, addiction, or suicide. The book will take you by the hand, walk you through that understanding, give you the confidence to be able to take the next step, to have a conversation or whatever it is that you need to do, and to give you some idea on some of the paths that you can follow. You can go to dasium.net to the store in the shop there and get your own copy.
Welcome back to Real Talk. I am putting us on alert today because I read a study out of U of M, and sometimes we talk about current events or studies and things like that on Real Talk, but today I read this study that lower grades actually directly correlate to lower self-esteem in our kids, especially at the collegiate level and the high school level. So I wanted to kind of go there because as a parent, when my kids were growing up, I didn't worry about it until they hit ninth grade. And then I went, oh, you need good grades to get into the right college, and you need good grades to be able to get a good job, and blah, 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 blah. So inadvertently, I went and put pressure, I think, that good grades, all A's. Now, mind you, C's are not good, weren't good in my book or whatever. So I just kind of want to open up that can of worms, get raw about everything we did right and wrong, and just talk about this idea that grades are a measure of success. Because I know that you and I both think about success very differently as a whole. And I want to talk about how grades affect that and impact that.
Yeah, grades are one of my soapbox items. I have serious issues with it. And I will preface this by saying I also don't have a better solution for a traditional school setting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is not me dissing the schools, because I don't know how I would do that, honestly. Mm-hmm. I have to look at other models or whatever. But I have serious issues with grades. One is, we homeschooled our kids for several years, and I thought a lot about it because people kept asking us about it, because we didn't give tests. We didn't grade their assignments. And people kept going, well, how do you know if they know it? I'm like, because we talk to them every day and we look at the work that they did. I mean, if they did their math homework and they got half of them wrong, then we go through it and we try and help them figure out what they didn't understand and help them get the concept. A grade wouldn't tell them that they didn't get the concept. The fact that they couldn't do the problem told them they didn't get the concept. Or if we had a discussion about a book that we read, I can tell what concepts they got or didn't. And the purpose of learning isn't to get a grade. The purpose of learning is to learn and to become a person who can think. And part of that process is making mistakes.
It's so just, interesting. It's so interesting you say it that way, because I look back on my own personal experience and I had the grades. Mm-hmm. I did. And I don't know anything. And this is full disclosure. Yeah. When it comes to history, geography, liberal arts, I don't know hardly anything. But I got straight A's in those subjects, mm-hmm. because what I was really good at was studying for a test and then regurgitating that information. The minute that information hit the table, whoosh, it was gone.
Yes. Ditto. Same thing.
And so that's one of the reasons why grades to me are this inaccurate way to measure knowledge. And I think the intent of grades is to measure knowledge. But sometimes it doesn't work that way and it impacts our kids emotionally in a very negative way.
I agree. My husband is a tutor and he works, well, he's a math tutor specifically, which is a challenging subject for many kids. And the thing that frustrates him the most are the kids who have test anxiety, because he knows they know the concepts.
Right.
They just don't test well. And we won't even get into my issues about types of testing, but not enough soapboxes for that. So one of the things that we did with our kids is that because they went to school for a little bit and then we homeschooled and then they went into the public schools, one for high school, one for 2 years of middle and then high school. So they were going into a system where they were going to be tested and they had not been being tested. But we had talked to them about it because they heard people asking us questions, or they would talk to other kids who are in school and they have to study for a test. And so we had these discussions about what tests were and what they really meant. And so my kids had a preconceived notion that tests were something that their parents didn't care about. We only wanted them to learn and to learn how to learn. And so fortunately, they didn't get the test anxiety to go with that. But I did see that as soon as they got back into the school system, they became grade focused, which is something I didn't want, because like you, Judy, I got the grades. I know, you know, that's just not an issue. But it doesn't mean I learned things. I even remember doing math with you. We were both math majors in college and we'd be sitting there and be doing the homework and I'm just like, phew, done. And you're like, but wait, why did this work? And I'm like, I don't care why it worked. It's just done.
Right.
I had to get the homework done. It's done.
And it's interesting because we all come to the table, if you will, with different ideas and behaviors or insights that we have picked up along the way. And I think it starts when our kids are really little and we reward them for the good report card, or we reward them, or we question,
why didn't you get an A, or why didn't you get a B, or what happened here?
Exactly. And I kind of giggle because I have a niece who is fantastic when it comes to school and grades, except gym. And she is like this cutie pie thing, and physical stuff is just not her thing. And she is so stressed out because she got a B in gym. Mm-hmm. And it's like this whole anxiety thing. It's that mindset around it that I encourage parents to kind of go, why are you focused on the grades? What is it that you think that represents? Because whatever that mindset that you have is somehow translating to your kid. And so if you see your child getting test anxiety and focusing only on the grades, it's really important to redirect that focus for them. And I know, Sandy, you might have some specifics that parents can do.
Well, that was one, is, you know, actually have the conversation with your kids about what are grades and what's really important. And the reason parents, you know, we want our kids to have good grades is to get into the college of their choice and to be successful. But we did the real talk on, I'm trying to remember the exact title, but it was Parents' Expectations, you know, how parents' dreams for their kids affect them. Right. So you can go to mightyparentingtv.com or go to mightyparenting.com and click on the TV thing, and you can watch that YouTube video, which is really interesting because it ties very directly into this. But we want our kids to have a good life. Well, here's the thing. Companies and even colleges are now learning that what they need are people who can think and learn.
Right.
Not people who get a 4.0. And that's going to become more and more prevalent. So teaching your kids how to learn, and then when they're going to interview, to address their grades, to grab that bull by the horns and say, hey, I don't get great grades because, and give the facts, I experience test anxiety and I have learned some techniques to deal with that and I've improved. However, I know how to learn. I have had to work harder at learning. So I actually have more techniques at my disposal, and give them that confidence back. Because that's the part that concerns me, Judy,
right,
is, you know, this study showing that the poor grades affects their confidence. And the most ridiculous thing about it is some of the most successful business people and entrepreneurs in our country, in fact, most of the ones that are hyper successful, got terrible grades. Many dropped out of school. There's the old Einstein thing. People who can solve problems and be successful and be happy aren't necessarily the ones who get the best grades. So the things parents can do very specifically are change our own thoughts and expectations, and then change our kids' thoughts and expectations, and take that conversation out into the culture. So when you go for a parent-teacher conference and the teacher's focused on the grade, you can tell the teacher, I'm not worried about their grade. I want to understand their learning process. I want to understand their problem solving. How are they doing with these specific skills? If you're talking to the school counselor, it's not the grades I'm concerned about. This is what I want for my child. And if we keep having those conversations, we'll change the culture.
Exactly. And, you know, just to wrap it up in a pretty little bow, I think you touched on the thing. It is how to change the expectations around grades and the powerful impact that can have on our kids' self-confidence, because it isn't about a grade. It is about the whole person. And that is what we want to focus on. That's the key to helping.
Who are you? Not what grades do you get.
Exactly. So I want to thank you all for joining us for this episode. And if it's your first time listening in, we want to just say welcome to Mighty Parenting.
Welcome.
We are more than just a podcast. We are a whole community. And we support each other as we raise our teens and parent our 20-somethings. And you can become a Mighty Parent by joining us over in the Mighty Parenting Facebook group or signing up for podcast alerts and things that come out on email, including a little gift over on mightyparenting.com. And until next time, this is Judy Davis and my cohort, Sandy Fowler, encouraging you to become a mighty parent.